Daniel chapter 11, a fulfilled prophecy by Raymond Hughes, a paper which appeared in the Testimony, September 2003. This article stems from the fact that for many years the present writer has been unable to accept our traditional and rarely questioned exposition of Daniel 11 verses 40 to 45, and even more so is unable to regard these verses as referring to the same time as Ezekiel 38 and 39. The writer appreciates that what follows does not represent the widely held Christadelphian standpoint on this prophecy, but he believes that it should be given consideration, if only to put the traditional views to the test. The following are some of the issues which need our careful consideration. In spite of verse 40 stating clearly that the kings of the north and south both in turn attack Rome, which is the power of verses 36 to 39, the traditional view is that they are in conflict with each other. The claim that the escape of Edom, Moab and Ammon in verse 41 is still in the future ignores Jeremiah 48, Isaiah 15, Isaiah 16 verses 1 to 5, a totally bankrupt Egypt has no treasures of gold and of silver today for any future invader to plunder. Although there's a footnote here that in Egypt 30 years on, an article that appeared in July 2002 in the Testimony, the footnoter, whose initials are NB, I reported a significant gold find at Sukari in Egypt. And in verse 45, the northern invader comes to his end with none to help him. Can this be applied to Gog's future invasion with his great host of allies in Ezekiel 38 verses 5 and 6? The first few verses leave us in no doubt that the prophecy is being presented in chronological order as a continuous historical record. This feature plays an important part in our understanding of the details, and like much of the book of Daniel, we have no use of symbol in this chapter. It is literal from start to finish. In the chapter there are several references to the end, and it is important in seeking to understand the prophecy that we do not automatically group them together and apply them all to the last days. The Apostle Paul says in Acts 17 that all nations have their appointed times, that is, a beginning and an end. The prophecy began to be fulfilled in 538 BC and covers more than 25 centuries of history, bringing us to the present time. The chapter proceeds in broad sweeps over the centuries, but always giving us sufficient detail to enable us to recognize just where we are in history. It commences at the fall of Babylon and the start of the Persian period with the reigns of Darius the Mede and Cyrus. Four kings were to follow. Daniel does not name them, but they were Cambyses, Smerdis, Darius, Hystaspes, and Xerxes, the latter probably being the Ahasuerus whom Esther married. Verse 3 brings us to the emergence of the Grecian power under Alexander the Great, the mighty king, who, humanly speaking, certainly did, according to his will, in his very rapid conquests. He defeated the Persians and took Syria and Egypt in his stride, and we're now at around 330 BC. A few years later, in 323, Alexander was dead. His army generals fought with each other, resulting ultimately in the fourfold division of the empire, about 20 years after Alexander's death, and a further 20 years on, after much conflict, the four divisions were reduced to two, and the two surviving powers, one to the northeast of Israel, the other to the southwest, became, in the prophecy, the king of the north and the king of the south. The former being the Seleucids, occupying Syria and adjacent territories, and the latter the Ptolemies, centered in Egypt. These two parties remain in view throughout the chapter, with one important exception. This is in verses 36 to 39, where the reference is simply to the kings. This divergence is easily accounted for, and we shall return to it later. Little Israel, in the meantime, was sandwiched between these two major powers and suffered greatly at the hands of one or the other. Verses 5 to 20 take us from 280 BC to 176 BC. In this period consisted mostly of warfare between the north and the south. There was a brief time of peace brought about by the marriage between the king of the south's daughter and the king of the north. This was but political intrigue, but how accurate is the fulfillment of the prophecy when checked against secular history? The end mentioned in verse 6 appears to apply to the end of the conflict, which allowed the marriage to take place. And verses 7 to 20 continue, giving an account of the years of warfare in which Israel suffered greatly. In verses 21 to 31, the infamous Antiochus Epiphanes comes on the scene. Reigning as king of the north for 12 years, and in his advances against Egypt, he greatly oppressed the Jews, capturing Jerusalem in 172 BC and again in 168 BC, and for a brief spell, the Jewish daily sacrifices were desecrated, and the resultant fury amongst the Jews resulted in their rebellion under the Maccabees and the eventual defeat of Antiochus's general Lycurus and the liberation of Jerusalem. At this time, the next major power, Rome, that is the little horn of Daniel 8, Rome came into ascendancy, interfering in the affairs of the divided Grecian Empire, both north and south. The ships of Chittim brought to Egypt Roman warlords who quickly stamped their authority by intervening in the conflict between Antiochus and Egypt. The general of the king of the north was confronted with a dilemma: to fight Rome or to submit. He chose to submit. and the complete submission of to Rome of both the King of the North and the King of the South took place over the next 150 years, during which time Rome was steadily increasing in power. Macedonia fell in 146 BC, Syria in 64, and Egypt in 31 BC. Verses 32 to 35 concern the Maccabean rebellion. God has always had his faithful remnant, and here they shone in their conflict with Antiochus Epiphanes, and the momentous events of these years must have been a great testing time for Jews, and under the purging, some fell away, whilst others came through the test and were made white as they upheld and defended the truth. They were helped by the Roman intervention mentioned above. What a great tribute we find to these faithful at the end of verse 32. With the fall of both the King of the North and the King of the South, we come to the end of the appointed time for the Grecian Empire, a few years before the birth of Christ. Whilst this is all part of the scene in these verses, the real subject matter of verses 32 to 35 is that of God's people and the time appointed of verses 35 is surely a reference to AD 70. In verses 36 to 39 we meet the king. For many centuries there were to be no separate kings of north and south. The king here is Rome. He has conquered both north and south and has grown from a little horn into the dreadful and terrible fourth beast. Here was a king who did not regard the gods of his fathers. In changing from paganism to Christianity in the days of the Emperor Constantine, nor the desire of women, a reference to clerical celibacy, the honouring of guardians or protectors. The margin for forces is Molzim, or God's protectors, and that refers to the canonizing of dead saints to become supposed protectors. The dividing of the land for gain is perhaps a reference to the church dividing the land into parishes for the collection of money. Truly, this is Rome before us in these few verses, but even a mighty Rome had its appointed time. Unlike Babylon's fall, however, which came in a single night, Rome's end was more prolonged. The prophecy then continues in verse 40, and at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him. After centuries of absence, the kings of the north and south are back in the picture. The continual use of the personal pronouns he, his, himself enables us to identify the him of verse 40 as being the Roman power. So, why the application of the him by some to Turkey here? When the time came for Roman supremacy in the East to end, the West having already fallen to the barbarians under the four trumpets of Revelation 8, a new king of the South was to push or attack Eastern Rome. It is important to note that the aggressor here is not Rome, but the king of the South. Revelation 9, under the symbol of the fifth trumpet, tells us about this new power from the south. It was the Arabs or Saracens who, as followers of the new religion of Islam, emerged from Arabia in the early 7th century AD, firstly under Muhammad and then under the caliphs who followed after his death. The Muslims conquered North Africa and Egypt. As the new occupant of this area, the Saracen invader became the king of the south. Palestine also fell to them, and for the next 300 years, they plundered the Eastern Roman Empire, but never fully conquered it. Verse 40 continues, "And the king of the north shall come against him," that is Rome, "like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." And this corresponds to the sixth trumpet of Revelation 9, prophetic of the rise of Turkey, that is the Ottoman Empire. Compare the words overflow and pass over with the way Revelation 9 links the rise of the Turks with the river Euphrates. And in chapter 16, its decline with the drying up of this river. The Turks took over the area to the north of Palestine, including Syria. And in doing so, they became the new king of the north and brought to an end the power of Rome in the east. Constantinople, the capital, falling to them in 1453, a famous date in history. This new king of the north came with horsemen. Revelation 9 says of the Turks, the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000. The Turks had little or no use of foot soldiers and relied almost totally on cavalry. And with reference to the many ships, Turkey had a powerful navy, the greatest of its day, and fought major sea battles. We pause to note here that this is the first occasion in Daniel 11 that the king of the north and the king of the south are not in conflict with each other. At this time, the common enemy was Rome, and this is important in the correct understanding of the prophecy. As he overflowed and passed over, the king of the north took the glorious land. Note that there is no mention of the children of the glorious land. Unlike the mention of Ammon's children in the same verse, because Israel's children were scattered abroad and had been for many years. The verse then tells us about those who escaped the Turkish armies, Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. The detail is wonderful. A Dr. Keith wrote of these times and countries, "The Turks often attempted in vain to subjugate them," and he refers to the partial escape of Ammon. and Dr. Adam Clark wrote of them. They were never subdued. 40,000 crowns of gold were paid to them annually by the Ottoman Turks to permit them free passage to Mecca. And according to Buckingham in his travels, writing of Ammon, the inhabitants of the greater part of that country live in a state of complete independence from the Turk. Verse 42 shows how the Turkish Empire would continue to overflow. Egypt was taken on 24th of August 1516 to become, as described by one writer, the jewel in the Turkish crown. And Turkey was quick to plunder the vast wealth that Egypt possessed at this time, taking all of its treasures. Libya and Ethiopia, that is the Sudan, were also taken. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. It is now Turkey who is in trouble. From the north and from the east of Turkey's capital, Constantinople, came bad news. Revolts against the Turkish oppressor. Initially, the Turks had great success in subduing these revolts, but God had decreed her drying up in the sixth vial prophecy. And therefore, one by one, she lost the countries that made up her empire. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Turkey, as a part of the Muslim world, like the Saracens before them, established their false worship in the glorious holy mountain, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And the crescent emblem, which is Turkish, not Saracen, as is sometimes said, rests above the mosque there to this day. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. In 1918, the Ottoman Empire, now almost dried up, was driven out of Palestine by the British under General Allenby. The once mighty power that had toppled the Eastern Roman Empire had come to be known as the sick man of Europe, and Turkey was truly alone with none to help him. Turkey was friendless. Having sided with Germany in World War I, she lost her previous close associate, Great Britain. Egypt was left bankrupt at this time, and still is. The treasures of silver and gold no longer exist for any would-be invader to plunder. The chapter break between Daniel 11 and 12 needs to be ignored to appreciate the full sense of the prophecy, because in the midst of this great event of Palestine's freedom from the Turk, Israel's very own angel, Michael, stood up on behalf of Daniel's people, and he had already engineered the Balfour Declaration, and his next task was to get God's people back into the land. And then there was the declaration of the State of Israel in 1948 to oversee. Michael was indeed very much occupied during this time. The returned Jews, outnumbered, it is said, some 100 to 1 by the Arabs, needed his guidance to achieve victory in the 4 major wars which followed, 1948, 56, 67 and 73. And the time of trouble, such as never was, has now surely commenced, bringing us in verse 2 to the resurrection, which cannot be far away. Rather than the foregoing detracting from our understanding of Ezekiel 38 and 39 and other prophecies such as Isaiah 15 and 16, the writer believes that it should actually help us to a clearer perception of them, which can perhaps be considered on another occasion. May our continued study of the prophets and our exchange of views be a means of preparing us for the kingdom, increasing both our faith in and obedience to the word, which alone can save us.